Tonight, we're going to talk about dead silence, fear and terror on the anthrax trail, also biogerm warfare, and these dead microbiologists. Bob Cohen, Eric Nadler, our special guest tonight, and they're next on Coast to Coast AM. We have two special guests for you this hour and for the rest of the show. Bob Cohen, filmmaker, journalist, war correspondent, whose work is always focused on uncovering hidden truths. He was based in Africa for 15 years as a correspondent for CNN International, receiving a major award for the best television war correspondent for his reporting from Liberia. He is also a consultant to the United Nations in conflict zones and humanitarian emergencies. Here's Bob Cohen, first of all. Hi, Bob. How are you?
Great to be with you, George.
Likewise. I'm looking forward to this, Bob. Eric Nadler, author, TV producer, filmmaker. He has written for Rolling Stone, Mother Jones, Harper's, and The New Republic, and his films featured on PBS, the Sundance Channel, and Court TV. He has produced several PBS Frontline programs, including the, remember the BCCI bank story? Well, he did that, the Bank of Crooks and Criminals and the Secret Arming of Saudi Arabia. Here's Eric Nadler. Eric, good to have you with us, too.
Great to be here, George.
With the work that you two have done, we could go on for 12 hours about the various things that you've done. I mean, just amazing work for both of you.
Thanks so much.
Dead silence. Let's start with you, Bob, and then you, Eric, and then let's just open it up for both of you. How did you, Bob, get involved with this?
Well, George, for me, this story's got a personal touch. I'm from Africa, from Zimbabwe, which used to be called Rhodesia. And that's where I grew up, and I came of age at a bloody civil war. And it's a little-known fact that the largest outbreak of anthrax in modern history took place in my home country during that war. And it's long been suspected that it was the result of biological warfare. And then during the course of my work as a journalist, I uncovered a lot of clues that I never really followed up on, but I was always fascinated by the use of biological weapons in southern Africa, covert use of biological weapons. And I left Africa and arrived in New York City in the weeks following 9/11, just as those anthrax attacks were happening. And basically was wondering whether perhaps there was a connection between the anthrax attacks in the United States and that outbreak in my home country. And that's what got me looking into this, and that's when I hooked up with my old colleague, Eric Nadler, who had been investigating the nuclear underground. And I'll let Eric sort of tell his story.
But okay, go ahead, Eric. Pick it up.
Yeah, for whatever reason, I've spent a good portion of my journalistic career involved in weapons of mass destruction matters. I did a film in 2002 called Stealing the Fire, which looked into the sale of nuclear weapon widgets on the black and gray markets, and went into the AQCon network, and we also had access to the only German convicted of nuclear espionage since Klaus Fuchs, a German engineer named Karl-Heinz Schaub, who stole uranium enrichment plants from the West and sold them to Saddam Hussein. And they caught him, and he pled guilty to treason, and he was fined $32,000 and given a suspended sentence.
Jeez.
So I kind of knew there was a lot to study in this area.
Let me ask you this even before we get into the major topic, Erica, because I've always wanted someone who understands this AQCon story.
Yeah.
Why was he only given basically house arrest, hand slap? I mean, did he know people, or is there a dark hidden secret?
Two things. One, he's a superhero in Pakistan. He's beloved. He gave the Muslim world the atomic bomb. This means he is a revered figure, very powerful. People demonstrate in the streets for him. Also, he assembled a clandestine network of front companies and other material procurers to get the equipment, the very specialized equipment to build a nuclear weapon. And these are Western firms with operations. They're multinationals, you know, in Germany, UK, and US.
Sure.
So he knows who's dirty, so they let him go with the wrist slap.
He knows too much, doesn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Which, you know, is a basis for a lot of your work in Dead Silence. I mean, this is far bigger a story than I think the mainstream media is not touching. And that, of course, brings up another question, both to you, Bob, and Eric. Why do we need top-notch investigators and journalists like you two to come up with stories like this, where the resources of these major networks, they just don't touch stories like this? Why not?
I've learned one thing in my years of international reporting, and I've worked for network news operations in the United States and for projects funded in Canada, UK, Germany, Australia. So I understand how national news bureaus approach various work. There is a line they draw in the American media. I don't think they get together in a room and draw it, but they kind of get their cues from people at high levels, and there are areas they won't investigate and stuff they won't follow up on, and this whole anthrax business is one of them.
Well, here we go. Anthrax attacks. Shortly after 9/11, all of a sudden we had this horrible thing happen in this country. We were panicked. We thought, of course, it was done by Islamic terrorists again, and we never truly got that answer at that time. And then all of a sudden the FBI fingered an individual who they had to, never really arrested, and then he sued, I believe, and got a lot of money for false charges and accusations. And then this person commits suicide. Tell me about Bruce Ivins. Who wants that?
Well, like you said, George, the anthrax attacks, they happened. They were, many people consider them the 1-2 punch, 9/11 anthrax attacks. And they kind of disappeared, for a long time. They kind of disappeared from consciousness. Everybody talks about 9/11. There's a memorial every year. But, those anthrax attacks kind of disappeared. And they did focus on Stephen Hatfield, the scientist. And they paid him a lot of money. You're right. It was almost $6 million, $5.8 million. They settled within the FBI. And that investigation went nowhere. And then last August, August 1st, the FBI announced that they had solved the anthrax attacks. And they had found another, their man, another U.S. Army scientist, Bruce Ivins, who was working at Fort Detrick, which is the U.S. Army's top biodefense, biowar germ lab down in Frederick, Maryland. And basically they said he's the guy who did it, and unfortunately he's dead. He's just committed suicide. And Eric and I were in the editing room finishing up our film that we just spent several years traveling around the world, actually following a trail of dead microbiome.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that. That's another fascinating
Bruce Ivins for us was, the latest in a long list. And so basically, the FBI quickly wanted to close this case. There'd be no trial. It'll never have to be proven in court.
Clean and simple for them.
Well, we interviewed the deputy commander of Fort Detrick, the place where Bruce Ivins worked. And those were his exact words. Nice and convenient, isn't it? So,
nice and convenient as well.
Yes, and we've interviewed Ivins' co-workers, and they are unanimous in at least the ones we talked to, are unanimous in the belief that he's innocent and was set up. And they say that the equipment at Fort Detrick and Ivins' skill set would not have allowed him to prepare the super sophisticated anthrax that were found in the envelopes sent to Capitol Hill. That was where the really fine anthrax powder went. In fact, when U.S. Army scientists in their full biohazard suits and, biosafety level 4 laboratory hermetically sealed chambers opened up the Leahy letter, and they wanted to put the powder onto slides, but it wouldn't stay on the slides. It floated into the air. It was a manufactured piece of business that people said was the most sophisticated anthrax they'd ever seen. Some people call it weaponized. That's a word that's debatable. But what the floating ability meant was that it could travel through the air and in very minute particle spores. 1 micron is what we learned the attack powders were, which is a phenomenally small piece of business. It's breathed into the into the lung where it infects and kills. And so someone was sending a signal that this was really very sophisticated anthrax. And Ivins didn't have the equipment or the ability to manufacture this by himself after hours, as the FBI claims. Nobody who seriously looks at the forensic evidence is buying Bruce Ivins' guilt. And the FBI has taken so much heat, they've had to refer the matter to the National Academy of Sciences to study the technical stuff. And we'll see what's going to happen with that.
Well, and did we know if Ivins even had an axe to grind? Was he upset with anybody, with government or anyone?
Well, certainly he was an eccentric fellow. I mean, the press in the days after his death was leaked all kinds of stories that, you know, he was mentally unstable. He had his obsession with the sorority. All sorts of stories. It's certainly he was an eccentric guy with a good sense of humor with his co-workers. But certainly, you know, we also have to remember, Ivins himself was part of the FBI investigation into the anthrax attacks early on. He'd been working with the FBI and in the lab and was part of that team. But at some point, the Fed started putting pressure on him. And certainly, you know, those last months of Ivins, he was was acting pretty crazy, drinking heavily, apparently, seeing a therapist. But he was under extreme sort of surveillance, apparently, by the FBI, and using very, very heavy-handed tactics and putting pressure on the guy.
Why did it stop? You know, we had this scare, we had deaths, and then it just stopped. It went away. What was the message? What did they want, whoever was behind this? What did they want us as Americans, maybe the world, to feel? But why did it stop? Eric?
It stopped because there's no real interest in getting to the bottom of this. This is a Pandora's box of terrible secrets that go to the development of the worst weapons known to man, germ weapons. This is very scary stuff. It's our biggest collective nightmare. And the FBI, from the get-go, clearly showed it was going after a lone gunman, you know, the Lee Harvey Oswald, Sirhan.
One crazy guy.
So. Yeah, he was eccentric, he drank, who knows. The FBI, one of the things they put out was that Ivins was working closely with the people who make the anthrax vaccine, the Bioport Corporation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the FBI said that he stood to profit through some patents he held from anything that would increase the demand for that vaccine, such as an anthrax attack. And so they're saying there could be a financial motive behind it. And that got Bob and I interested in looking into the money side of things.
Sure.
You know, we're old-style Woodward and Bernstein veteran.
Follow the trail.
Yeah, and the money. Follow the money. And that's what we did when we got on our anthrax journey.
I've always told myself, Bob and Eric, who benefits, and then follow that path, and you'll probably get pretty darn close. In this particular case, the anthrax scare, who benefits, in your opinion?
Oh, definitely. Billions of dollars are being spent. So it's big pharmaceutical concerns. It's universities, it's medical foundations, it's multinational drug companies. They clearly have demonstrably gained. Since the anthrax attacks, the U.S. government has given out the contracts or awarded contracts for $57 billion.
Oh, my God.
Which used to be a lot of money, George, you know, before,
yeah.
Before all the
bad. Not anymore.
Yeah, I know, but it's still a lot of money, and it's $57 billion that we know of. That's without even getting into the black budget.
Does this, in your investigation, shed some kind of light on this entire 9/11, the anthrax scare? We'll talk about the dead microbiologists in a moment. Does this shed some kind of, going into Iraq, some kind of stigma over all of it? Is this all connected?
Well, we have. It's a good thing you bring up Iraq, George, because we have to remember that, you know, anthrax was one of the main justifications for that, you know, war and invasion of Iraq. Because remember, Colin Powell went to the UN and he held up that little vial and he said, "This is what
yes.
This was what was sent in the letters." And Saddam Hussein's got tons of this stuff, and that became one of the main justifications in the invasion. But what we discovered in our investigation that this, in fact, was a fairly small world that was all connected. Every you know, this germ warfare world, it's not a lot of people, and there's a very rich history of cooperation that stretches across continents, decades, and even enemies, supposedly enemies, were working together on this. Soviets and the UK, South Africa. So it's actually a very small world. And if we take it to Iraq, who supplied the anthrax that built up Saddam Hussein's germ warfare program originally?
It was us.
Exactly. So we knew. We sent the stuff around the world. And there's actually an international trade in this in this field of germ warfare.
Now, even though it's a small group, are they powerful? Are they wealthy?
Oh, yes, they're extremely wealthy, and they're extremely politically wired. We looked at who's getting the money, and these corporations, I'll give you a quick example, the company that makes the vaccine, Bioport, they came into existence when a German-Lebanese telecom executive with no expertise in vaccine work or scientific education, a man by the name of Fouad El-Hibre, took over the Bioport Corporation in a sale. You know, he was the Bioport Corporation. They bought the Michigan State vaccine, anthrax vaccine facility.
It was right. That was where they were really located for a while, right?
Right.
In Lansing, Michigan, I think.
Yeah. And they spent, I believe it was $10 million up front, but they got a business partner that came in very handy, the former chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral William Crow, who served as Joint Chiefs under, I think it was Reagan, and then in Clinton, he was appointed U.S. Ambassador to London. Well, he came back from London, and he hooked up with the anthrax vaccine company, Bioport. And so these are very powerful people who are very wired. Later, Bioport was able to hire lobbyists from Dick Cheney's former staff, big guys who got paid top dollar to work their way through the FDA for the exclusive contract for the anthrax vaccine when they were under challenge. This is big business with a lot of political juice on Capitol Hill.
And without an anthrax scare or some kind of anthrax attack, there's no need for vaccine, is there?
Absolutely. Not only the vaccine, but this whole biodefense. You see, what's really happened is we've seen a boom, an explosion in this biodefense industry, what we call the bioterror military industrial complex, which has benefited from these $57 billion since those anthrax attacks, and which, you know, one of the big things about all this, it's all become privatized, or it's become more and more privatized. So now you have what used to be the domain of secret government programs is now become big business. And once it crosses over into the private sector, it's hard to look into it. There's what could be government activity, they can hide behind these companies. What goes on in these labs are protected by corporate and trade secrets. And so basically, you've got university labs, private corporations, private foundations, all cashing in on this big biodefense boom, and we don't know what's really going on in those labs.
We're going to talk about the suicide of David Kelly when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And could this global germ war arms race push us into a major catastrophe on this planet? Up next, as we continue talking Dead Silence on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. David Kelly, He died in 2003, apparently committed suicide. He was an expert in biological warfare and a former United Nations weapons inspector in Iraq. And he worked, of course, for the British government. Back, Bob Cohen, Eric Nadler. Tell us a little bit more about David Kelly, if you can.
David Kelly was the fellow we call the man who knew too much. He was at the very epicenter of government and intelligence operations involving biological weapons and germ war. He headed the British division at Porton Down, the microbiology division, for years, and served as a germ weapons inspector when the Soviet Union fell and the Russians opened the facilities to the West. David Kelly went in there. He also was the man to whom the leading Soviet germ war expert defected. He defected to the West, and he was debriefed by David Kelly. And so Kelly knew all the Soviet secrets as told him by the defector. And Kelly was also a UN's weapon inspector in Iraq. So when he dies a mysterious death, which the forensic evidence clearly shows is murder. In fact, a British member of Parliament, Norman Baker, took a year off to study the Kelly situation, and he wrote a book, and he titled it The Murder of David Kelly. The question is, who would kill the man who knew too much? And that's the question.
And what did the man who knew too much threaten to do? What was he going to say where they needed to silence him? What do you think?
Well, the cover story, George, if you remember, was that just after the invasion of Iraq, one of the big justifications was that Iraq had this 45-minute capability that they could hit London with a germ bomb in 45 minutes. And after the invasion, the British press was leaked that a senior British government official had said that all that those intelligence claims, that dossier had been, quote, sexed up. And it emerged, it was leaked that person was David Kelly. And he was hauled before Parliament and grilled, and there was a huge media sensation. It was almost brought down the Blair government. And then he took that walk in the woods and was found dead in the woods by this supposed suicide. And so the media has just focused on this. As, oh, this is the guy who might have leaked that the intelligence claims of Iraq were sexed up. But no one has really looked at what was the world that David Kelly was part of, that germ warfare world. So the media never looked at that. And that's one of the things that we focused. You know, what did actually David Kelly do? And where was he working? And we began by looking at the lab that he headed, the microbiology department.
Very top secret lab it was.
Very much so. That's Porton Down, and that was, been around since the 1930s. But that's the center of the British bio war bio defense complex, one of the most secret labs in the world, and one that was working closely with the Americans and the Canadians. It was a special relationship from the Second World War well into the 60s and 70s of shared research, manufacturing of germ weapons. And Porton Down and all these labs are places of secrets, and there's some skeletons hidden there that people don't want to come out. And we basically uncovered a legacy of human experimentation at Porton Down.
With what, like criminals or prisoners or anything like that?
No, these were servicemen, George. That's the amazing thing.
Oh,
these were ordinary
no.
servicemen who were given, there was a notice put up on the notice board, said we need volunteers for experiments to find a cure to the common cold.
Oh, and we'll pay you for this?
Well, we'll give
or
you
were
a
they
couple,
going for honor?
Well, no, they were given a few more shillings, and you could have an extra day, long weekend, and little perks for servicemen. And so, scores of servicemen signed up for these experiments, and some of these experiments involved testing of chemical and germ agents, sarin gas, because the amazing thing about all this germ warfare stuff, you have to test it to know if it works. You can test that on the rats and all that stuff, but how do you know if this stuff works? And this is, you know, one of the dark secrets of Portendown. And in fact, you know, some of these survivors of these experiments, these servicemen, and nobody knows how many have died.
Oh, my God.
There's some people reporting that there are untold numbers that have actually disappeared.
Were they all Brits or are some Americans?
Brits. I'm not sure about Americans that were part of the Portendown, but we have our own legacy here, which we can get into a little later
okay.
on. There were Canadians as well. And so these guys basically began protesting. They got some local MPs. They were making noise. And finally, the police, the Wiltshire Police, which is the area that Portendown is in, they opened up the biggest investigation, that police department, with 13 detectives, and it stretched on for more than 2 years, this police investigation. At the end of the day, they believe they'd gathered enough evidence to call for the prosecution of Portendown scientists, Ministry of Defense officials, and they handed that to the Crown Prosecution Service in the UK. And the very strange thing about all this, well, let me go back and say these experiments took place between the 1940s right up to 1989 at a time when David Kelly was head of microbiology at Portendown. And in all the press and media attention, and there was a big inquiry, Blair got Lord Hutton, one of the top judges, to hold this public inquiry, which many people say was just a whitewash. In all the media attention and all the Hutton reports, nobody mentions that perhaps David Kelly's involvement in those human experiments might have something to do with it. And 3 days or 4 days before David Kelly committed suicide, Crown Prosecution Service quietly announced that they were not going to bring forth any prosecutions in this case. So that was one of the very interesting things that we found out about the dark side of David Kelly. There's also his connections with the Soviets, his relationship with the Soviet scientists who defected, and also a very dark secret, and perhaps the darkest, was what was his relationship with a man called Dr. Death in South Africa, who headed their secret apartheid-era germ warfare program.
Tell me about that, and why would that be a major story?
Well, you know, I told you, George, that funny, the story began in my home country of Zimbabwe,
right.
Rhodesia, where the anthrax, well, you know, that neighbor's South Africa. And at the end of the war, a lot of the special forces and who were part of the deployment and use of the chemical and biological agents moved over to South Africa. A lot of people did not want to see black rule in Zimbabwe and moved to South Africa, which at the time, height of apartheid, was the last bastion of white rule on the continent. And South Africa developed very sort of in the early 80s, decided to start up a secret germ warfare program called Project Coast. And it was headed by this army cardiologist by the name of Wouter Basson. And he was later to be dubbed Dr. Death. And he assembled a group of 200 scientists, set up front companies, and basically went around the world using intelligence connections and big companies, front companies they had set up all around the world, and get technology for germ warfare, and had developed these relationships with the West, including, you know, David Kelly, including Fort Detrick, a lab where Bruce Ivins worked. And Dr. Death and his team of scientists developed germ weapons that they could use for assassination of anti-apartheid activists. They could perhaps use against the black population at large. And one of the darkest things that they actually worked to develop was an ethnic weapon, a germ weapon that would target the black population.
Jeez.
And they were actually working on...
Based on DNA, I would assume, right?
Certainly part of it, for sure. And one of the things that they were actually trying to come up with was a vaccine that could sterilize black women without their knowledge. It's something they could put in the water. There's a lot of questions of whether that actually they were able to develop it or not. But
And used it.
Exactly. There are a lot of unanswered questions about Project Coast and what happened at the fall of apartheid. The British government, the U.S. government, the ambassadors, put a lot of pressure on the South Africans to shut down, not only shut down Project Coast, but to destroy all the documentation. And basically, it only came to light in 1996. If you remember, there was something called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, which allowed former security agents from the apartheid regime to come and say, look, these are things we did. They would get immunity and from prosecution.
Do you two think that AIDS might have been developed in a lab and let go? I mean, it's just too coincidental, which I don't believe in, that all these diseases would pop up all of a sudden.
Well, it's a very interesting point you bring up, George, especially when we remember South Africa and my home country, Zimbabwe, have got some of the highest AIDS rate in the world, 25% plus. And if you go to some of the rural areas, and this is a fascinating thing for me, some of the rural areas of Zimbabwe, which were at the epicenter of these wars, and these were bloody wars of liberation, the AIDS rates are as high as 55% in some of these places. And we know for a fact that Project Coast and Dr. Death played around with AIDS. And there are a lot of questions being asked. Now, that's something we did not really get into the film, but or the book. I mean, that's a whole, you know, other...
That's one all by itself.
Absolutely. I mean, and it certainly, warrants serious looking into, because there are all kinds of documents that even here in the United States basically show that the U.S. government itself would have plans and was interested in developing a new form of biological weapon that would be refractory to the immune system as early as 1969.
If they developed, for example, AIDS, wouldn't they have already had then the vaccine ready to go too?
Well, we don't know.
I mean, do you make these germ warfare organisms and not have the vaccine ready?
Well, this is all speculation, obviously, but if the aim is population control, maybe not.
But they don't want to catch it, so, you know, they want to be immune to it.
Well, it opens up a whole can of worms, George, but one of the things that we did in this film was, Dr. Death was actually put on trial in South Africa, and that was for 30 months, but it was actually let go, found not guilty. It was a highly politicized trial. There was no jury. There was a judge. The fix was in. But some of the things came out in this trial, and that a lot of interesting clues. But Dr. Death has not spoken to the press much. But we tracked him down in South Africa. We sat down with him and asked him about a lot of these things, about the ethnic weapon, for instance. And he did confirm on camera that, yes, indeed, we were trying to do this. And we were asked to do this for another country that had a population explosion problem.
Interesting.
And I said, what is that country? And he said, no, I can't tell you that. So, it opens up a lot of questions. But one of the things we asked him, he said, did you go to the West? Did you go to Port and Down? Did you go to Fort Detrick? He said, yes. Did you meet David Kelly? I had a relationship with him. I met him 3 or 4 times with exchange of information. So here you had Dr. Death, who admitted working on this ethnic germ weapon, confirming that he had a relationship with Dr. Kelly. There was an exchange of information. We don't know. We might never know the true story.
You know, years ago, Bob and Eric, whenever I would hear conspiracy stories, I would say, other than the Lee Harvey Oswald JFK one, because I've always believed that there was more than one involved in that, but I would always say, no, these people are wrong, or they're nuts, or come on. Now it's the other way around for me. Now I believe the so-called conspiracy theorists are the ones who are right. I think the other stories are the ones that are wrong, and it's frightening.
Well, George, we, of course, have been called many things. One of them is conspiracy theorists, and I want to read you something from our book, if you got a minute, that
sure
goes right to this point. We covered a hearing last September at the House Judiciary Committee, where the FBI Director Mueller was testifying. And at the point in the hearing, Senator Patrick Leahy, who was head of the committee and himself a target of one of the anthrax letters, addressed Mueller directly. And Leahy hasn't spoken much publicly about the attacks and what it meant to him to be a victim. And we called the office a few months before that hearing, and his press spokesman said Senator Leahy never discusses the anthrax attacks. So when he spoke to Mueller, we listened. And let me just read you this.
Okay.
Leahy spoke with gravitas in his languid voice, chiding the director for bureaucratic bamboozlement. Finally, he dropped his detachment. I have been very reluctant to even ask questions about this because my office and myself were put at risk because of a letter that was addressed to me, and I realized we did not suffer like the families of those who had people die. And then he concluded, I do not believe in any way, shape, or manner that Ivins is the only person involved in this attack on Congress and the American people. I do not believe that at all. I believe there are others involved, either as accessories before or after the fact. I believe there are others who could be charged with murder. The chairman of the United States Senate Judiciary Committee was charging conspiracy and cover-up at the center of one of the FBI's biggest cases ever, and it was being broadcast live on C-SPAN. This was not internet chatter or conspiracy theory, but a powerful challenge to powerful interest by an impeccable source. It was a fantastic and important story, but one that, for whatever reasons, would be ignored by the media, even cable.
You know, you're right about that, too. And they continue to ignore these stories. We pound away at it, and thank God we have people like you two who pound away at it. And maybe eventually we'll win out. I've always heard that the so-called Illuminati would love to have a population on this planet of 500 million, down from the 6-plus billion that we have now. Have you heard those statistics tossed around?
No. I mean, I'm not familiar with the Illuminati theory or predictions.
Okay. How about you, Bob?
Not specifically, but basically, there's one. It's certainly something you hear about, and you know, one of the things that we discovered in South Africa is that basically one of the things that about that South African program that developed these supposedly ethnic weapons and all sorts of nasty germs. Supposedly, that all those germs were supposedly destroyed and dumped into the South Atlantic Ocean after the fall of apartheid. But very interestingly enough, a few months after the anthrax attacks, a former scientist and colleague of Dr. showed up in Washington and said, we've got a lot of germs we can sell you from the old program. We've got anthrax antibodies, and all kinds of wonderful germs that would be useful to you. And basically, there was a plan put in place to see if these guys were for real. And what transpired was that there's apparently a whole stockpile of these germs hidden away somewhere in South Africa on a farm or in the desert. We don't know where those germs are. But what unraveled in an investigation that was covered by the Washington Post and among others, it was basically that the CIA and the FBI got involved to find out if this was true.
Let's find out a little bit more about this. This is a major story. Plus, we'll talk about these dead microbiologists when we come back on Coast to Coast AM.